What happens when a cabal of secular progressive technocrats takes over an historic traditional liberal arts college? In one vivid instance, things get out of hand pretty quickly. Co-opted meetings with rigged agendas, intrusion of outside experts, intercepted mail, new offices of pseudo-scientific analytics, propaganda campaigns and media manipulation, ugly architecture and exploitation of hallowed land, sale of college property, egregious lawbreaking, installation of mindless figureheads, rent-seeking self-enrichment, ruthless retaliation against the disloyal, elimination of intransigent personnel, hatred of the crucifix, the very denial of truth about human nature. Now that's all pure fantasy, of course. The product of the fruitful imagination of an Oxford don 75 years ago. What I described was the vision of C.S. Lewis in That Hideous Strength, in which a humble, humane campus becomes the field of cosmic, spiritual warfare, with dark forces mocking and subverting the classical ideals of truth, beauty, and goodness, and undermining the Christian vision of the human person. I will have more to say momentarily about why Lewis chooses progressive technocrats at a small liberal arts college as agents of evil, but I must acknowledge first that Lewis's imaginative exercise might seem rather far afield from the topic I was invited to speak about, Wendell Berry's political philosophy and its relation to the tradition of Catholic social thought. As I reflected on that assignment, I realized that part of treating those topics should include communicating that Wendell Berry is not a political philosopher, and that what we today call Catholic social teaching is a novel and even rather tenuous development with an uncertain future and a contested relationship to the Catholic intellectual tradition and the mission of the Church. So if you will bear with me, I hope that C.S. Lewis's fictional narrative can provide some of the imaginative space we need to properly address the scope and significance of socio-political thought in Wendell Berry and the Catholic tradition. C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength is set at fictional Bracton College, a venerable English university. As the novel begins, we see the faculty being manipulated into submitting to the authority of the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments, NICE, you see what Lewis did there, an outfit determined to remake the world through technologically enabled social engineering. The NICE agenda is a version of what we would today call transhumanism, to eliminate suffering and inefficiencies by remaking human nature, literally transposing minds to something less vulnerable, messy, and mortal than our biological bodies, and so eliminating the need for things like families, towns, trees, and traditional colleges. Some of the novel's characters and the central drama connect it to the prior two novels in Lewis's so-called space trilogy, which take us elsewhere in the solar system to consider the history of man's fall from grace in Out of the Silent Planet, that was published in 1938, and to imagine what human life would be like without that fall in Paralandra, which was published in 1943. That Hideous Strength returns us to Earth, but although it stands well enough on its own as a novel, its more mundane setting has not left behind the otherworldly element. While the campus novel is a recognizable genre, in almost every way this does not count. There are barely any references to students, and the only commentary on ordinary academic politics is how vulnerable professors are to the temptations of vanity and the manipulations of bureaucrats. Most of the novel is taken up with the extraordinary, even supernatural politics of the battle against NICE. Conspicuously, Lewis embeds his story in ancient legend, classical myth, and Christian theology, so that, as absurd as it might sound in summary, pagan gods, angels and demons, King Arthur and Merlin, and God himself all make appearances in the novel. George Orwell, appreciative of Lewis's political warning against a scientific totalitarianism, objected that the supernatural element was unnecessary. And it is true that the mythological, angelic, and divine forces can sometimes seem to weaken Lewis's attempt to depict human beings in real and recognizable relationships, to highlight normal human temptations, and to play out the implications of various insights and ideological trends. Many of the themes of That Hideous Strength, Lewis treats more prosaically and quite successfully elsewhere. He began writing the novel in 1942 and was mostly finished in 1943. By the time he published it in 1945, he was explicit that the novel embodied the central ideas of The Abolition of Man, which had been published in 1944. Especially the idea of a natural law, the dangers of a scientism distorting ethics, language, and thought, and the threat of totalitarian power through the conquest of nature, which, as Lewis pointed out, is really always the conquest of some human beings over others. The novel also explores the character of temptation that Lewis had exhibited in the Screwtape Letters of 1942, the dangers of a certain kind of vanity and ambition that Lewis had warned about in an essay lecture, The Inner Ring, of 1944, and the reality of fall and redemption in ways that Lewis envisioned in The Great Divorce, also of 1945. The novel also prefigures much of Lewis's reflections on affection, friendship, and marriage that will show up 15 years later in The Four Loves. Given the prominence of the personal conflict between the main characters, Mark and Jane Studdock, husband and wife, one could even argue that more than academia, it is marriage, in particular the temptations and trials of modern companionate marriage, that is the real ordinary locus of Lewis's drama. But Lewis could not have left out the supernatural element to which Orwell objected. He sought not only to dramatize philosophical ideas, nor to narrate a recognizable human story, which he could do in any ordinary tragedy or comedy, but to do so in a way that integrates these with a whole tradition of imaginative literature, legend, poetry, and myth, especially the true myth of Christian revelation. Allusions to faith in modern England are not enough. Lewis must make us feel homesick for Logris, that's a name for Arthur's realm. He must resurrect Merlin and subject the hierarchy of angels to Christ. For this exercise in poetic daring, the muses don't only inspire, they take center stage. Lewis subtitled That Hideous Strength, A Modern Fairy Tale for Grown-Ups. So, an invitation to imaginative openness to truths unseen. But his preface calls it more straightforwardly, a tall story about devilry. Spiritual forces, good and evil, more powerful than man and yet under God's providence, are essential to Lewis's depiction of a merely human drama of temptation, struggle, and redemption. Lewis wants to tell a story about the betrayal of nature and its restoration, and the supernatural presence helps him to do this in two ways. First, nature itself is not a given, but it is under a higher authority. Nature is creation, designed by a creator. Second, the betrayal of nature, especially of human nature, is not merely a failure or a brokenness, but a manifestation of evil, a dark, rebellious, and fearsomely dangerous power. It might sound a bit melodramatic to attribute the actions of bureaucrats and technocrats to evil spirits, but Lewis has a point. Just as good and helpful actions, however meritorious, must be referred ultimately to God's grace, so too, bad and harmful actions may have as their immediate causes frail human beings, false ideologies, vanity, and pride, which may in turn all be instruments of darker forces. In God's providence, we don't always understand the fullness of evil behind what is destructive and revolting. So it is not entirely unrealistic for Lewis to characterize moves for modern efficiency, pragmatism, even relief of suffering, as more than merely foolish, short-sighted, selfish, and wrong, but as devilish. It may even be a kind of charity and mercy to the technocrats and bureaucrats, not to attribute the bad consequences of their actions to bad motives. It is criticism enough to point out that they are hubristic and stupid, failing to recognize the human implications of their actions. A failure of reasoning, more than a failure of will, and perhaps even a failure of imagination, more than a failure of reasoning. As Lewis was exploring, something about modern methods of knowing and making have not only magnified the consequences of ordinary human foibles, but narrowed the scope of our spiritual vision, so that fallen man, in trying to conquer nature, has cooperated in his own subjection to dark and destructive cosmic forces. Perhaps now you can anticipate why I prefaced some remarks about the political wisdom of Kentucky farmer Wendell Berry with some background about an Englishman's theological fantasy novel. It's daunting enough to try to summarize the thought of Wendell Berry, to sketch his main themes and do justice to his personality and voice. But I think it is helpful to understand Berry's general project as responding to the same historical situation which Lewis was warning about, namely one in which new techniques of human organization were displacing and replacing traditional human actions and relationships, and new technologies and attitudes towards nature were threatening something essential in the human condition. Of all the themes associated with Wendell Berry, the importance of limits and place, localism and humane scale, membership as work and as gift, the virtues of humility, gratitude, and hope, the farm and marriage as models and metaphors for all human relationships, even his concrete examples of woodlots and topsoil, all circulate around a judgment of the fundamental difference between the organism and the machine, between the ecosystem and the factory. Berry helps us to recall that life is a miracle. That's the title of one of his books. That is, that man's natural powers are only fully appreciated as a mysterious expression of a supernatural source. And whatever threatens humane living is not only impractical and unwise, but morally repugnant and spiritually destructive. Berry's most well-known book, The Unsettling of America, includes an epigraph from Lewis's That Hideous Strength. At the beginning of chapter 8, which is called Jefferson, Morrill, and the Upper Crust, Berry quotes a passage about the dangers of abstraction, how a certain approach to knowledge can lead us away from the concrete realities of nature, so that nature is not only ignored, but in a sense falsified. Berry's chapter is about how government policy has violated a trust, turning land-grant colleges, originally founded to foster healthy communities of farming, against actual farmers and their communities. And here is a paragraph, which I will read from Wendell Berry. The tragedy of the land-grant acts is that their moral imperative came finally to have nowhere to rest except on the careers of specialists whose standards and operating procedures were amoral. The objective practitioners of the science of agriculture, whose minds have no direction other than that laid out by career necessity and the logic of experimentation. They have no apparent moral allegiances or bearings or limits. Their work thus inevitably serves whatever power is greatest. That power at present is the industrial economy, of which agribusiness is a part. Lacking any moral force or vision of its own, the objective expertise of the agriculture specialist points like a compass needle toward the greater good of the agribusiness corporations. The objectivity of the laboratory functions in the world as indifference. Knowledge without responsibility is merchandise, and greed provides its applications. Thus Wendell Berry. What Berry chooses as an epigraph for this chapter is a description of Mark Studdock, Lewis's tempted professor, whose academic profession of sociology has made him so blind to actual human society, and therefore a sucker for manipulation by those more malicious than himself. So here's the C.S. Lewis quote that Wendell Berry uses. His education had had the curious effect of making things that he read and wrote more real to him than things he saw. Statistics about agricultural laborers were the substance. Any real ditcher, plowman, or farmer's boy was a shadow. Though he had never noticed it himself, he had a great reluctance in his work ever to use such words as man or woman. He preferred to write about vocational groups elements, classes, and populations. For in his own way, he believed as firmly as any mystic in the superior reality of the things that are not seen. Mark, like the academics in some of Wendell Berry's fiction, has no genuine literacy and is an expert at things he knows nothing about. In a later description, Lewis describes him as quite ignorant of the life of the roads, although he had once written a very authoritative article about vagrancy. Berry quotes another passage from That Hideous Strength in The Unsettling of America. The chapter, Living in the Future, the Modern Agricultural Ideal, is a central one and one of the longest. I can't summarize it, but I'll give you a sense of what it's about by reading Berry's section headings. The Domestication of Absence, The Vagrant Sovereign, The Manufactured Paradise, The Colonization of the Future, Let Them Eat the Future, The Organization of Disorder, Where Are the People? Deserts of Vast Technology. The chapter ends with this sentence, which is often quoted: if we do not live where we work, and when we work, we are wasting our lives, and our work too. The overall thesis of Berry's chapter is that on farms and in general, modern progress of human power ignores and wastes human beings and disguises from us the horror of doing so. So Berry chose, as an epigraph to this chapter, a passage from That Hideous Strength about the modern ambition of man conquering nature through science, which had to begin with the suppression of man's natural instincts of piety and awe before nature. So here's Lewis again, quoted by Berry. Dreams of the far future destiny of man were dragging up from its shallow and unquiet grave the old dream of man as God. The very experience of the dissecting room and the pathological laboratory were breeding a conviction that the stifling of all deep-set repugnances was the first essential for progress. Berry quotes that same Lewis passage in Life is a Miracle. Berry is a superb essayist, and what makes him hard to summarize and even hard to quote selectively is that his writing embodies an attitude, a habit of mind, which is forcefully instructive, concrete, and real. He is the opposite of Mark Stevic. Berry is better described perhaps as a prophet than a theorist, but one of his classic essays does take time to articulate some principles, which we may take as a distillation of a political or social theory. The essay is Two Economies, and it begins by reflecting on a discussion of how to describe an economy more comprehensive than the money economy or the industrial economy. An economy comprehensive enough to include all the values that need to be accounted for, but are often ignored in conventional accountings. Berry's friend, Wes Jackson, reaching for something to call it, strikes on the kingdom of God. And here's what Berry says. I assume that Wes used the term because he found it, at that point in our conversation, indispensable. I assume so because, in my pondering over its occurrence at that point, I have found it indispensable myself. For the thing that troubles us about the industrial economy is exactly that it is not comprehensive enough, that moreover it tends to destroy what it does not comprehend, and that it is dependent upon much that it does not comprehend. And then Berry continues. In attempting to criticize this non-comprehensive economy, we naturally pose against it an economy that does not leave anything out. And we can say, without presuming too much, that the first principle of the kingdom of God is that it includes everything. In it, the fall of every sparrow is a significant event. We are in it whether we know it or not, and whether we wish to be or not. Everything counts. Everything has value. And we do not make this economy, but find ourselves in it, along with everyone and everything else. And so then, here's Berry again, another principle, both ecological and traditional, is that everything in the kingdom of God is joined both to it and to everything else that is in it. That is to say, the kingdom of God is orderly. By this point, it should be clear that while Berry envisions a comprehensive economy, and one that is orderly, he he could hardly be called a totalitarian. A totalitarian seeks to impose an artificial order, a simplified, uniform, and static order, on something against its independent and dynamic nature. Far from being totalitarian, Berry's vision, like other versions of agrarianism or distributism, is strictly against the centralization of power of any sort, the power of the state, the power of technology, the power of industry. But neither does this resistance to centralized power imply an individualistic libertarianism, since Berry also recognizes that there are healthy and authoritative organic systems. What matters is scale. Berry recognizes that nature includes nested hierarchies of complex, even mysterious order, from the organization of a political community, to the life of a farm, to the organic processes in healthy topsoil. Berry is a localist of nested hierarchies, a fractal localist in the recent coinage of Nassim Taleb. Berry's vision of a comprehensive economy thus requires a respect for order at each scale, and for the whole in which the smaller systems are contained. Fundamentally, this implies disciplined humility, even piety. And so here is Wendell Berry's third principle. Humans do not and can never know either all the creatures that the kingdom of God contains or the whole pattern or order by which it contains them. The kingdom of God, which Berry also calls the Tao, which might be another nod to C.S. Lewis, he also, more commonly in this essay, calls the great economy. While kingdom emphasizes God's sovereignty, and the Tao, the economy's eternal unchanging quality, the great economy evokes our participation in a dynamic system. And so, to these three principles, Berry eventually adds a fourth. Though we cannot produce a complete and even adequate description of this order, severe penalties are in store for us if we presume upon it or violate it. In risk management terms, this is just a precautionary principle. In the terms of some political theorists, this is a recognition of the tacit wisdom encoded in naturally evolved processes. In classical ethics, it points to the virtues of care, humility, and respect. This especially requires an admission of the limits of our knowledge and the need for deference, I might even say piety, before what is greater than us. And so the fifth and last principle of the great economy that Berry makes explicit: we cannot foresee an end to it. The same basic stuff is going to be shifting from one form to another, so far as we know, forever. As far as I know, the academic philosopher who has done the most to integrate Berry's political insight into a more conventional political theory is Alistair MacIntyre, whose reflections on the politics of small-scale local community integrates Berry's common sense with the Aristotelian philosophical tradition. MacIntyre, like Berry, promotes a vision that is neither left nor right, neither socialist nor capitalist, but respectful of the local, organic, living systems of human scale. MacIntyre's most influential book, After Virtue, traces the history of moral thought in order to distill a stark choice between nihilism and a teleological vision of the person, Nietzsche or Aristotle. That's a chapter title, and it basically distills the penultimate thesis of the book. By the end of After Virtue, MacIntyre has refined the choice. Nietzsche or Aristotle, Trotsky, and Saint Benedict. We are used to allusions to Saint Benedict, especially MacIntyre's hope for another, doubtless very different, Saint Benedict, who represents a radical, supernaturally inspired attempt to build humane forms of community. Arguments about the character and feasibility of a Benedict option notwithstanding, we should remember the other part of the formula. Trotsky represents a response to the new social and economic realities of modernity, which have organized human life on a scale inconceivable to ancient citizens of the polis. Aristotle, in other words, provides the insights about human nature and ethics, but cannot alone address the new problems that arise from the great transformation of social life affected by industrial technology, modern finance, and the rise of the nation state. In MacIntyre's shorthand, if St. Benedict stands for a radical and optimistic recovery of community, Trotsky stands for a sober, critical, even pessimistic assessment of the new social conditions of modernity. This same insight of McIntyre's is essential to understanding what is meant by Catholic social teaching. A strict Aristotelian recently asked me, what work is the word social doing in that phrase? The perceptive question arises because we already have Catholic moral teaching and even Catholic political teaching. If these aren't simply parts of an overall Catholic teaching about the practical life of man, the social animal, what new or distinct area of thought do we intend to mark out by speaking of Catholic social teaching? The answer, I think, is that Catholic teaching didn't have to develop new moral or political principles, but, as McIntyre saw, it had to respond to new social realities. So here is a first thesis about Catholic social teaching, that it is not so much a set of topics or a principled and timeless doctrine, but a response to particular developments in human history. It is common to introduce Catholic social teaching in terms of various issues, trade, poverty, immigration, the environment, or of key concepts like rights, religious freedom, structures of sin. But this could seem like an arbitrary set of issues and themes. Why these and not others? Say, the problem of usury, or just war theory, or topics in sex and marriage. It is somewhat better to summarize Catholic social teaching in terms of some key principles. Subsidiarity and solidarity, the preferential option for the poor, human dignity, the common good. Even so, this seems inadequate, and the plain fact is that there is no clear canon of Catholic social teaching, and the collection of documents associated with it, including what appeared as the provisionally summative Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church, it's a big, imposing-looking book, do not represent an obviously coherent body of teaching. Russell Hittinger, the preeminent historian of Catholic social teaching, has observed that it is not presented as either a philosophical synthesis nor as a coherent historical narrative. It doesn't have the structure of a set of disputed questions, and it's not even clear whether it represents itself as a doctrinal or pastoral pronouncement. There is a hint of order and organization in the table of contents of the compendium, but Hittinger is right that you could read the compendium's paragraphs backwards or in any order without much loss. If Catholic social teaching is more a collection of reflections than a unified canon, we can still see that it was born and continued to develop as a reaction to new and historically contingent social circumstances, which demanded not new teaching, but new application of traditional teachings. The ex post facto construction of a history of Catholic social teaching always identifies its original document as Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, on new things. As the Catechism of the Catholic Church puts it, the social doctrine of the Church developed in the 19th century when the gospel encountered modern industrial society with its new structures for the production of consumer goods, its new concept of society, the state, and authority, and its new forms of labor and ownership. Not to argue with the Catechism, but I would only add that Catholic social teaching is more than an application of the gospel. It's a new application of common sense. The Industrial Revolution, the rise of the nation state, technological and legal transformations of economic life all created new problems that required a new and increasingly explicit articulation of what was once tacit knowledge encoded in the structure of everyday life. The principle of subsidiarity, just to take one example, is something we now see as a fundamental truth about human organization. But it used to be so fundamental that natural limits of human life, which prevented it from being systematically violated, meant it never even had to be formulated. It was really only articulated as such, as a principle of subsidiarity, when new circumstances created the possibility of political forms contrary to the principle of subsidiarity. Only then did it need to be consciously chosen and articulated. So here is another important feature of Catholic social teaching, and I'll make this my second thesis, that it is not an alternative economic system or ideology. It doesn't fit the standard categories of left or right, and it isn't a compromise between them. Here is John Paul II. The church's social doctrine is not a third way between liberal capitalism and Marxist collectivism, nor even a possible alternative to other solutions less radically opposed to one another. Rather, it constitutes a category of its own. Nor is it an ideology, he says, but rather the accurate formulation of the results of a careful reflection on the complex realities of human existence in society and in the international order, in the light of faith and of the church's tradition and of common sense. Catholic social teaching draws new attention to things previously taken for granted in pre-industrial modes of human life. If most of what we associate with Catholic social teaching is directly relevant to political and economic practice, so I mentioned subsidiarity, solidarity, the preferential option for the poor, it also makes sense that it extends to any topics that arise in a distinctive way in modern social circumstances, such as environmental stewardship. Modern developments have magnified man's power to cause environmental damage, while simultaneously making it easier for us to forget our dependence on and responsibility to the Earth's natural resources and processes. This leads to my third thesis about Catholic social teaching, which is that the modern historical developments to which Catholic social teaching is a response can all be understood as artificially magnifying the effects of sin. Put simply, developments in the 18th and 19th centuries changed the scale of certain social arrangements, thus increasing the political, economic, and technological power of some human beings, and transforming the quantity and quality of the effects of sin. The church's opposition to totalitarianism, which is a distinctively modern phenomenon, right? Totalitarianism adds to tyranny new forms of political, economic, and ideological power to dominate on a massive scale. That's the most obvious example. And it's in opposition to totalitarianism that Catholic social teaching starts. The French philosopher Pierre Manon has pointed out that the church gained moral authority as it lost political power. And one of the first things that the church used its isolated moral authority for was to point out that the nation state loses its moral authority as it concentrated political power. Technology or industrial methods have the capacity not only to magnify sin's effects, but to insulate human agents from their sense of responsibility for sin. The modern bureaucrat, administrator, or politician can almost completely externalize the costs of his bad decisions. Moreover, certain forms of technology even hypnotize agents into ignoring that they have any agency, even when they claim to be merely labor-saving devices, increasing efficiency. Some technologies are actually act-replacing, displacing human relationships and practices with impersonal processes. So an entertainment industry replaces local practices of leisure. Poorly conceived welfare policies replace charity and thrift. And the policy of mutually assured destruction replaces traditional political diplomacy. Those examples, by the way, come from Wendell Berry and from Russ Hittinger. That distinction between labor-saving devices and act-replacing devices, I think, is key to both of them. From this perspective, it makes sense that Catholic social teaching encompasses so many particular issues. In addition to obvious ones of general political organization and economic life, we can include distinctively modern challenges about immigration, race, the environment, and perhaps we could even interpret the church's recent statements about capital punishment as a manifestation of Catholic social teaching in this sense. In other words, there seems to be a practical reassessment of the moral authority of the modern state more than a change in the moral teaching about just punishment. Consider also Humanae Vitae, the encyclical against contraception, especially chemical contraception. Can't this be read as another social teaching responding to novel technologies? While the encyclical has led to controversy when read as a traditional moral argument, it is plain common sense if read as an application of the precautionary principle to the dynamics of marriage and family life. It is a sociological fact, not a theological or moral conviction, that the contraceptive pill diminishes the social value of chastity and functionally transforms the nature of marriage. In this light, We might also see other particular areas of important social life as virtually included in Catholic social teaching. Don't Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman offer something akin to Catholic social teaching on the topic of mass media consumption? On urban planning, don't we have Jane Jacobs and the New Urbanists? And then, for that matter, isn't Wendell Berry, along with the Catholic Rural Life Movement, essentially extending Catholic social teaching not only, but most specifically, to farm policy? In all of these areas, modern developments have magnified man's power and magnified the effect of man's sinful abuse of power, requiring ever more specific and explicit articulation of how to reduce and avoid devastation and restore humane patterns of life. Whether about the state, the economy, the environment, or family policy, Catholic social teaching addresses a technologically enabled scale problem in human sinfulness. From this emerges my fourth thesis, that while Catholic social teaching does not always apply revealed truths of the gospel to new problems, it does depend on the biblical understanding of human nature as having a received integrity from God, a created and fallen nature which must cooperate with its own redemption. Without a theological conception of human beings as fallen creatures, it is possible to make pragmatic judgments that align with Catholic social teaching. But the effectiveness of those judgments, their persuasiveness, is greatly increased by the belief that there is more to life than pragmatics. Nothing instills humility, caution, and care like conviction in the sinfulness of man, and nothing motivates action like the fear of hell and the hope of heaven. Despite its pragmatic insight, Catholic social teaching at the end of the day is not mere risk management. It is a call to live according to a higher order, to actively participate in fulfilling a call from a loving and benevolent God. It also cannot be left out of any appreciation of the political wisdom of Wendell Berry, that he writes as a man of faith, a practitioner of the word as an image of the divine word. Berry is a Christian poet. And this leads, finally, to my fifth thesis about Catholic social teaching, that the challenges it is designed to meet cannot be met without rhetorical resources from outside of Catholic social teaching. The truths that Catholic social teaching articulates are made effective by imaginative, visionary, literary voices. The principles and the arguments need to be enlivened by poets and prophets. Lewis saw this, which is why he was moved to complement his essay expositing the abolition of man with a novel envisioning that hideous strength. And it is why so many people who would never read political theory, much less be moved by it, or study a papal encyclical, have been fruitfully moved by Wendell Berry, and why Catholics have so eagerly learned from Berry, not only what he communicates, but how. Berry, like Lewis, had a literary imagination that drew from and reached toward theological vision. Berry might be more subtle than Lewis, but it is not an exaggeration to say that his stories also envision heaven and human life in light of heaven. However heartbreaking his novels can be, and they've made me cry, they are comedies in the classical and Christian sense, resolving in marriage, literal and figurative, if not on earth, at least in heaven. And this is why we should not be surprised to find in Berry one more, and my last, example of a reference to that hideous strength. This time, an appreciation of Lewis's novel as a whole, and for precisely the reason that Orwell criticized it. Its vision is not merely political, but theological. Commenting on the way that pagan myths survive in Christian literature, Berry writes this. This survival has its apotheosis, it seems to me, in C.S. Lewis's novel, That Hideous Strength, at the end of which the Greek planetary deities reappear on Earth as angels. Lewis wrote as a Christian who had read Homer, but he had read, obviously, as a man whose imagination was not encumbered with any clinical apparatus, such as the willing suspension of disbelief. As such a reader, this is still Berry, though he was a Christian, his reading had told him that the pagan gods retained a certain authority and commanded a certain assent. Like many of his forebears in English literary tradition, he yearned towards them. Their triumphant return at the end of that hideous string, as members of the heavenly hierarchy of Christianity, is not altogether a surprise. It is a profound resolution, not only in the novel itself, but in the history of English literature. One hears the ghosts of Spencer and Milton sighing with relief. Lewis's odd novel has received high praise, but I know of no higher praise than this from a novelist who himself seeks to participate in and extend the tradition of Christian literature. This passage appears in Barry's essay, The Loss of the University, which describes the destructive effects of the industrial mindset on college education. On the factory model, workers separate themselves into specialized tasks, losing a vision of the whole, in this case, the whole process of forming the human being. I don't dare summarize The Loss of the University, which deserves to be read, studied, and meditated upon by anyone involved in higher education. Graduate students flagging and in need of encouragement, faculty designing curriculum, administrators losing perspective of purpose, higher education journalists and consultants who need to break out of prepackaged narratives about best practices, university trustees who want to learn about the grave responsibility that has been entrusted to them. I will only note that the central argument is that university education can only serve society if, in view of a supernatural horizon, it trains students in the arts of truth-seeking. This is exactly the central point of Ex Corde Ecclesiae, John Paul II's profound encyclical on the mission of the Catholic University. Somewhat as I suggested for Humana Vitae, couldn't we read Ex Corde not as a disciplinary or doctrinal text, but as a reminder and articulation of basic truths about education that new social conditions have hidden from us? Modern ideology, politics, and economics threaten the old ideal of an institution consecrated to truth-seeking. Ex Corde Ecclesiae is Catholic social teaching applied to the university. So, what would really happen if a cabal of progressive technocrats took over a traditional liberal arts college? It might happen so slowly that nobody noticed. Or it could happen suddenly as an openly hostile takeover. In either case, we could expect shallow stories in the Chronicle of Higher Education about the clash between academic and business cultures, or about the tragic conflict between humanistic idealism and practical economic realities. But with some historical perspective, the practical and theological insight of Catholic social thought and the poetic imagination of C.S. Lewis and Wendell Berry, we might be equipped to place the story in a larger narrative context and see that takeover for what it really is, a manifestation of devilry, a repugnant and inhumane attack on a precious, even sacred community. And perhaps that might give us courage and hope to defend and preserve the community, calling for help on the communion of saints and the heavenly hosts of angels, so that in God's providence, the potential tragedy turns out to be a comedy, part of the great comedy in which we are all invited to share. Thank you.
All right, if Professor Hochschild is willing, we're going to have brief Q&A.
Absolutely. Love to take questions. Love to take questions. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your talk. This is really great. I wanted to ask about what political solutions are available right now to fight against the industrial technocratic the elites that you're talking about, right? So, for example, here at UT, you have administrators that say that they want to meet goals on waste reduction and recycling, but actually we are sitting on a land grant full of oil and gas that is going to be routed to Houston soon with the Permian Highway. And then also, another Texas example, you have Denton and the community there, their own township wants to fight against fracking, but it got shot down by the state legislature, which is mostly, you know, paid off representatives, Republicans, who always favor oil and gas. So how can we try to fight against some of these interests for oil and gas that disrupt the agrarian ideal that we're trying to fight for?
That's a great question, and I'll probably disappoint you with my answer. But there might not be like a simple answer to that question, right?
Yeah.
You didn't put it this way, but like, what activist step should we take? It's not about activism. If you had power in one of those circumstances, if you were on the board of trustees at this university, or if you lived in that town and were part of the town planning commission, or if you were an executive in the fracking industry, then we could talk about what you can do. But are you a student here? You're a student here. So you should filter the garbage and get down to business and read stuff that's worth reading. So that when you are in a position of responsibility and have power, you see through the garbage and can discern what's real.
So there are students who are advocating for divestment here locally at UT from oil and gas. And in November, there's going to be a meeting of like the Board of Regents and Trustees who manage the lands that we have in West Texas with oil. So there are concrete examples of ways in which students can leverage their power right now in the moment. So how can we best like achieve that like on the legislative front?
So now I probably will not just disappoint you but offend you. But I'm really cynical about student activism. I'm cynical about activism, but I'm especially cynical about student activism. The most radical thing you can do is to filter the garbage and read things worth reading. If you want to be an activist, then leave the university. You are wasting people's time and resources. If you're a student, there's something you're supposed to do as a student. And if you are convinced that you are called to do something else, somewhere else, for some other cause, then do that. But stop being a student. Yes?
Thank you, Joshua. So, you mentioned a lot about how social teaching, and in this current pontificate, I found myself thinking a lot about the authority of the magisterium. And obviously that's really poignant in the case of Catholic social teaching because, you know, there's this common thought about the power of the magisterium, that there's doctrine, and that's where the magisterium can come in and bind consciences to give religious submission of intellect to principles. And then there's prudential questions where traditionally, when I talk to other Catholics, they act as if, well, the magisterium doesn't have power over prudential questions.
Right.
But I think that can't possibly be right. I mean, there's two extreme views you have on this matter, right, where you think maybe on one hand, the power of the magisterium extends only to matters of faith and principles of morality, and can't bind consciences whatsoever as to the application of those principles. Or you go to the other extreme, right, where you say, no, magisterium can bring it about that you have an obligation to give religious submission of the intellect as to every single moral judgment it may make, down to the most applied, most fact-bound questions. So I was talking to Alex Proust recently about this, and we both seem to have no good idea of it. Both of those answers seem wrong.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem as if magisterium itself or anybody else is giving us good guidance as to how applied the moral judgments of Catholic social teaching can get before they're too applied carry the kind of authority that requires religious submission of intellect. I wonder if you can give us an insight about that.
I don't know if I have a solution, but I probably would look in this direction. Instead of accepting only the distinction between principles and application, which is a valid distinction, right? I would also want to introduce a distinction between levels of principles.
Sure.
And a lot of what I think is going on in Catholic social teaching is a formulation of secondary principles, right? That they're not applications, but they're further specifications of things that have always been known as primary, more general principles. And I mean, certainly I think that's what's going on in Humanitate about sexual ethics. So that's the direction that I would look. But then, of course, the other thing that you have to get into is not just how do you apply principles, whether primary, secondary, tertiary, to practical situations, but what kind of practical situation is it, right? So if you're talking about an individual action, right, in sexual ethics, I think it's usually pretty clear, like you're talking about husband and wife, right, or people who could be husband and wife. But when you're talking about clean water, there's like multiple paragraphs on clean water in the compendium of Catholic social teaching, more than there is on the different kinds of justice. Who makes decisions about clean water? I mean, everybody and nobody. In some places, governments have direct authority. It's like we're all sort of implicated. Maybe our constitution has something to say about it. It doesn't about water, but it does about some other things, right? So gun policy. Right, so it implicates natural law, different social organizations, civil law, basic civil law, constitutional law, and then more ad hoc civil. It very quickly gets very messy, right? So what do you? How do you clean up the rivers? It's not application or principles. It's everything. It's all of life.
Thanks.
That's not an answer, right? It's just an articulation of why it's such a messy problem.
Right.
I think. Yes, sir.
It seems to me that sometimes when it comes to like these Catholic social principles, we sort of maybe we'll agree with them. We want to see them in practice, but we sort of go towards the means of the men at nice or mark in terms of like trying to accomplish them. So I was curious if you agreed with that assessment, and what exactly you see as sort of like the path to sort of like really living these things out on a personal level. Like,
do you have particular examples in mind? I want to make sure I understand what you're suggesting.
Yeah, let me try to put it more concretely. It's sort of like the whole like idea of like people complaining, I guess, about like what the bishop should do, what people in certain positions of authority should do, which is valid. We can complain about that.
Yep.
But I don't see a lot of like grassroots ways of like living these things out. So, like, how do you apply these things to life in general, besides sort of sitting and intellectually discussing them?
Wendell Berry, is sometimes asked, well, what can I not, like, I read your stuff and I believe what you're saying, so like, should I go and be a farmer? He's like, no, if you don't have a farm, you can't go and be a farmer, right? So then, okay, if I like what you're doing or what you're saying, like, what do I do? He said, well, what I'm describing is a habit of mine. I'm trying to teach people a way of looking at the world, to see certain things that are hidden from them, to ignore certain things that are total BS, but everybody thinks is real. Like, he's trying to form a habit of mind. So what can you do? You can form your habits of mind, and you can help other people form other habits of mind, and you can notice when there are bad habits that you can help to break. You know, making fun of higher ed journalists is, you know, or whatever it is, every opportunity. Go ahead.
First of all, thank you for your talk. This was very insightful and helpful. I have a question. I guess it's sort of half-baked. I'm trying to think it through myself. About the distinction between social teaching and political teaching. Or social body, political body. Because it seems as though there's this kind of struggle to grasp social teaching. The church itself seems to not really understand what it is, and it's hard to sort of put into terms. But you mentioned earlier that not just moral teaching, but political teaching, the church has, there's something a little more tangible there that we can grasp, that we can sort of latch onto, without the church becoming like saying how we have to arrange our governments or something like that, because that is something that is a matter of prudence in particulars. But might there be something to the idea that framing these issues in more explicitly political terms would kind of energize ordinary people, kind of these decentralized locuses of decision making, you know, people as higher education administrators, to actually think of their terms as, to think of their sort of mission not as simply building a society, which is sort of nebulous and vague, but as something that's kind of civic, to sort of revert to a more Aristotelian understanding of politics.
Yeah.
That is, I feel like that would be healthier, and I'm a political scientist in training, so I'm probably biased, but can you speak to that?
I think that's a very, very insightful question. And I think that, you know, the church is still learning how to talk about what it's trying to talk about. I mean, part of what I did in my paper was blur the lines between what counts as Catholic social teaching and what doesn't. We trace it back to Rerum Novarum, which was 1891, right? But it wasn't talked about that way then. It's really, you know, barely 50 years that we've talked about there being such a thing as Catholic social teaching, which is no time at all in church, in the church's time scale. So it might develop that way. I believe at one point the idea of calling it a civic teaching or a civic doctrine was considered, or people used that term for a time. But the reason, this is something that I read in a paper by Russ Hittinger, the reason that the word social was chosen is that the question of citizenship wasn't the issue, right? Maybe it should be, because maybe we have like too binary a notion of citizenship or something like that. But the best words, and maybe this is because sociology was a new science at the time or something like that, the best words to describe the new things to which the church was trying to respond was that they were new social conditions. It's a vague, nebulous term, and so its strength may very well be the kind of weakness that you're describing too. Like, we might need to refine it or choose some new words or add to it some further subcategories or something like that.
I guess fighting vagueness with vagueness doesn't seem to be the correct approach, but...
Yeah, the word social wasn't chosen to do the work of the solution. The word social was chosen to describe the problem, and the problem is nebulous, so the word was meant to comprehend that, I think. Yes, sir.
This might not help by making things less ambiguous, but I think one way, maybe, if I'm thinking about this correctly, it'd be great to hear your thoughts. It seems that as we are catechized and used kind of, Eastern Orthodox idea, divinized through our, you know, our participation in the sacraments and the life of the church, we, to whatever capacity we can, then sanctify the world in our various sort of spheres of influence.
Yep.
And it seems that what we're saying about Catholic social teaching is kind of the church's way of trying to instruct the faithful in that pursuit of sanctifying the kind of the post-industrialized world. And what I assume from what you've said is really what we need to do is seek to understand the world and seek to understand our current situation historically, politically, and spiritually, And then as we continue to be sanctified and as we grow in our understanding of our current situation and our place in the world, we can better influence it with the grace that we're receiving from the church.
I think that's very well put.
And that can be, that's in all these various aspects, be it political, agricultural, industrial, social, etc. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's right. And I think you can find passages like that in documents about Catholic social teaching, that it's not an alternative to the call to holiness, right? It's an extension of the call to holiness. And in fact, people who are not seeking to make themselves, put themselves on that path, right, to grow ever closer to God, are not capable of fulfilling the real call of serving others and building a just society.
If I may, one thing. It sounded like what you had said about the manifestation of devilishness. Mm-hmm. It seems the people who are in these positions of influence, like you had said earlier, who have not and are not being shaped into that image of Christ. And that seems to be the call that we have.
Yeah, to evangelize them. I think that's right.
Yeah. So this is, I feel like a lot of my questions have been kind of a little vague and like, we've kind of been like dancing around, which we don't really know how to like ask what we're trying to ask. And so that's...
I've been really flattered. It feels like people expect me to solve the world's problem.
So I like a lot of what I've heard about Barry, but a lot of it, he seems very vague himself. So I'm wondering if I could just, so three things that I noted, that he seemed to be against specialization, factories, and science, in a sense of like, the mastery in nature, and we kind of manipulate it. And so is that true? Are those bad things? And if they are, why are they bad? If they're not, what exactly is he saying about those?
Specialization, what was the second one?
Specialization, factories, and science.
Factories and science. So he's against over-specialization, or a kind of specialization where you lose sight of the purpose for which you're doing something. Right? So if you he uses the factory model for this. I'll say more about factories in a minute. But he uses the factory model for this because, and this has actually been confirmed by social science research. So modern factories don't operate this way, but the old assembly line method, right? There's a product and the factory is building this product, but no individual person is aware of the whole and even doesn't even understand how their rivet or their joint fits into the whole. All they do is rivet or add the joint or whatever, right? So that's dehumanizing. Psychologically, it's dehumanizing. And factories that are organized that way are actually not very productive. So factories that organize into teams of people who have a sense of how they're working together on a common purpose turn out to be more effective factories. So I think Barry is right that over-specialization is bad. Are factories bad? No, but factories are a very common metaphor for a new form of work, right? So obviously there are going to be better factories and worse factories.
So it's the machine versus the organism?
It's the same metaphor.
Instead of receiving like a natural system?
Yeah. So accepting the metaphor that an ecosystem is more complicated and dynamic and alive than a factory doesn't require you to then say, well, let's close all the factories, right? But it might change, if you were a business owner, you might change the way that you organize your workforce and the kind of factory that you wanted to build. What was the last thing? Science. He's against scientism, or the idea that there's a certain empirical measurable standard that everything must conform to or be ignored. Like any poet, you have to allow some room for metaphor, for imagery, for flexibility of terminology. If he's gonna put an idea out there, you can't be too literalistic in the application or extension of that idea to other domains without without getting inside his habit of mind and understanding how he would extend.
So if I could add a follow-up.
Sure.
So I guess for me, why it matters is because a lot of the ambiguity I feel like can be used. So let's take like the organic factory, right? Versus like, say we call it the humanizing and then we mandate, like some people like say, okay, we've got it in our heads, so we're going to do it a different way, right? We're going to kind of, and it ends up being less efficient. So you could have claimed that it wouldn't be less efficient, but say it is. Like, couldn't a real world consequence be like less production? And then if there's less production, that kind of sounds, oh, well, you're just kind of like an economics person. Well, then there's real world consequences for that. So you could have more poverty, right? If you produce less food because you're too worried about factory farms, people are going to die.
Well, so here's something, I mean, there's a lot in Barry that I didn't talk about. You can always hold Barry to this. It's one of his principles from The Great Economy. Right? You've got to include everything. So if you tell me that you have a means of producing food that is more efficient, and therefore it's going to feed more people and save more lives and therefore be better, I'm going to say, well, Barry has trained me to ask, okay, have you accounted for all of the costs? Is there a pollution cost? Are we losing topsoil? Do we have to make ourselves more vulnerable to certain kinds of pests because we're getting everybody to farm the same crop instead of having diversity of crops?
More people have to commute and lose time with their families because they don't have their own farms.
Are you destroying towns in order to have this new kind of, I mean, in an exaggerated way, right? In the C.S. Lewis novel, they literally do imagine, since forests are kind of messy and dirty, like, we'll get rid of them, pave over them, and if people want shade, we'll build mechanical trees. And by some standard, that would be more efficient, right? No standard that any of us are even tempted to, but by some standard, that would be more efficient. I mean, they'll last longer, and they're not going to burn, no forest fires anymore, right? But let's account for what's lost. And this is something that Barry is very good at, but it's also, it's an important basic principle of economics, right? There are always opportunity costs. And it's really easy to see the consequences that are there, but it takes incredible imagination to notice the costs of what is unseen, right? The things that didn't happen because of this, or the people who yeah. He's not a Luddite. He's not against markets or capitalism. He's not proposing that we all go back to hunting and gathering or farming. He's simply asking for us at all times, wherever we are, like, work extra hard to count the costs of what you're doing. Because what you think is efficient because it's gonna get you somewhere quicker today or tomorrow, right, might have consequences over a lifetime or generations, et cetera.
So on that kind of aspirational goal, my biggest take from Wendell Berry is the ability to paint this picture of a world or an ideal world for us to strive for. My question is, do you think that such a world is feasible within the constraints of modern secular American life and society, or would something, I mean, I'm just giving this as an example, but something more along the lines of the Benedict option, or more localized, you know, subsistence, something like the Kibbutz program or something like that?
I don't think Wendell Berry would ever want to formulate a template for us to follow. I think he wants everybody to be more intentional and responsible in making their life choices. But that might look very different for different people. I think he paints an ideal, but the ideal that he paints is heaven. And what he paints in the real world is always broken. Even in Port William, Kentucky, this fictional world, right? I've talked to people who read that novel and they think it's romanticized and idealistic, but those are English professors who don't, have like lost the ability to read novels or something. They're full of brokenness and sin and racism and war and death. I mean, it's not idealized. But they are full of people, some of whom make better choices and some of whom make worse choices, and some of whom make sacrifices that are a multi-generation gift to their community, and some of whom come in and, because of one stupid choice, destroy a woodlawn. Right? So that's what I don't think he's saying, here's what you do, right? You gotta homeschool your kids, you gotta get, for a lot of families, I think homeschooling will be part of their responsible work, but not for every family, right? If you live in a community with a healthy school, by all means, like, a school is often an anchor of a community, so join it and be part of it, right? And maybe you don't, but you see the opportunity to build a school, so you'll try to build it. But if you sense you're in a place where there's no chance to successfully build a school, then do something else. There's not one way to do this. And only you can know what are the circumstances of your place, because it's not my place. I haven't been there. I don't know your family, I don't know your neighbors, I don't know, you know, where you came from or where you're going. So it
seems that people are so transient today that even answer those questions would be difficult.
That's another one, and I think if Barry does have like some advice that he wishes more people would do this, he wishes more people would find a way to find themselves rooted. Choose a place and make it yours. That's not very efficient in certain ways, although it pays incredible dividends in ways that you can't always foresee or